C2PR. Number 11A.
We go to the second prayer, the prayer of spirit. And the epitomes that we have here are on the study material is runs like this: the prayer of reflecting the divine being. So you hear at once the tone of spirit. Spirit reflects. Spirit gives a pure reflection. So the tone of spirit is right here, the prayer of reflecting the divine being. And now through what channel? Through the culturing of spiritual qualities. So we have now our spirit, the spiritual qualities, which brings us into unity with spirit. With what aspect of spirit? With the unfoldment of spirit. Because it shows that if we culture spiritual qualities, that these spiritual qualities will bring us further, that will unfold, so to say, our spiritual growth. And this is naturally very important, because we always want to have spiritual growth. That's innate in us. That's our devotion to Christian Science, that we want to grow spiritually. And the question is, what is the prayer that brings about this spiritual growth? And so the second prayer is all about this prayer of reflecting the divine being, reflecting how. How do we reflect? Do we reflect as many people think they reflect God? If they smile, say yes, and how lovely, you are wonderful. Huh? And you reflect the divine being. Isn't it nice? Whereas spiritually seen, scientifically seen, this reflection is brought out through spiritual qualities that we entertain in our consciousness, in our mind. So we have a great sense of the worship of the spiritual that comes in. We know that spirit is characterized by worship. The worship of the spiritual, worship is a religious term. We can also say by devotion. That's another way of reflecting God, by putting everything we have into the study. See, you get the sense of the substantialization of our desire. So that which the first prayer has shown us as a true desire, that we put now something into that desire, that we make it really substantially substantial, spiritually substantial, so that it isn't just a desire that we feel with and speak, about which we talk and entertain just in the thought. It must now go deeper than thinking, than motive. Now it must get a substance. It must be substantialized through spiritual qualities. So the question which I have asked then right away after you have this caption is, through which spiritual qualities can this reflection be brought forth? Do you see the tone or hear the tone of spirit? Spirit that has to do with spiritual qualities that bring about the reflection and then bring forth unfoldment. All right. Now, the very first thing that we find when we read the text is spirit as mind. So I go to the text in the textbook, still with the intention to teach text interpretation and not so much inspiring the students. They can get inspired when they understand the subject, and that inspiration comes all by itself to everyone then. And so when we read now the very first sentence here, I guess somehow that you will feel at once that the subject that we have been considering yesterday as the prayer of mind is changing now to the prayer of spirit, that there is a definite change in tonality which is brought into the text. Because it says right away, the divine being must be reflected by man. You see, you at once feel, oh, this is so much different than what we have seen up to now. There it was all a question about the desire, how the desire must be molded, what kind of an inward attitude and motivation we should have. And now suddenly you get the sense, oh, but the divine being must be reflected by man. That man must show forth a reflection of the divine being. And therefore, one would at once notice a great break in the flow of the subject. And we would suddenly say, here something quite different starts. And what is that difference? You are always asking, I wonder what is the difference? And you are in a position of expectancy and say, I wonder what's now coming. I wonder how this reflection is now being shown forth. What is necessary to reflect the divine being? See, you always must be a scientist, not a religionist. The religionist reads and says, this is a doctrine, and what is said here, that I accept. The scientist is different. He is always questioning the text, questioning the subject, always in a sense of expectancy, what is coming. I wonder what is coming. Is it okay? Is it logic what is coming? Is it consistent what's coming? So you see, is it in tune? All these questions well up in one's consciousness when one approaches the text as a scientist. So here we have that the divine being must be reflected by man, and then a dash, which means now it is explained what it means. As man is not the image and likeness, we can see he is not really the reflection, the image and likeness of what? But now she depicts that divine being, the likeness of the patient, tender, and true, the one altogether lovely. That sounds a bit biblical, a bit religious, but that's also something one has to consider, that Mrs. Eddy had to speak to a religious age, or to a religion, not so much to a religious age, but to a religious population at that third time. And her great point was, how can I lead the religious thought out of the religious thinking into a scientific consciousness? Therefore, at the beginning of the textbook, so much is being presented in a religious terminology, falling back on the Bible, so that there is not too great a gap between the new student and the textbook, that he finds somewhere as a lover of the Bible, that he finds somewhere a bridge, an opening, that he can enter into the more scientific age. So here she depicts now this divine being as the one altogether lovely. Again, you get the sense of love. and not so much of spirit. Again, you feel that the second scriptural note has its place here, that Mrs. Eddy would say, yes, you know, man must reflect the divine being, and gives again right away a sense of the promise of that reflection, of the beauty of that reflection, says, you know, it is the reflection of the highest you can think of the one altogether lovely. So, we have not yet really found a tone of mind in it, only a little bit the proposition that of spirit, but not spirit as mind yet, just spirit, and that spirit has a promise that it will lead us in spiritual growth to reflect the highest sense of God, the altogether lovely. But now comes, after the semicolon, comes the real point. But to understand God, suddenly she speaks of understanding God. Up to now, in the prayer of mind, it was just knowing God as he is, that mind knows all. Now, the further step from knowing is understanding. And we are touched by the tone of spirit again. But to understand God is the work of eternity and demands what? Now comes the point. Now comes the attitude. Prayer is all attitude. What kind of attitude is now necessary in order to reflect the divine being? She says, I tell you exactly, it is consecration. Of what? Is it consecration? What is consecration? When you turn it to a synonym term, it's spirit. Huh? Because consecration is to focus everything on one point. It's the focal point of spirit, where all the rays of infinite truth are really focused just on one thing. So the moment we hear about consecration, we know that it is putting everything into the balance of, into the one and only thing there is. And so we get the consecration. But the consecration of what? Of mind. Namely, the consecration of thought, energy, and desire. See, of thought and desire, which was the subject of the first prayer. First prayer was all about about the right motive, about thinking in the right direction, that thought is molded into the right direction, and gives the sense of true desire in the first subject mind. And now spirit comes and says, but this prayer of mind, the whole prayer of mind, the whole prayer of desire, must now be the object of our deepest consecration. We must put something into it. And that putting something, that's the substance, that spiritual substance. And suddenly we can begin to realize that the second prayer is actually telling nothing more than that you have to take the first prayer and make that your inner substance. And making that your inner substance means that we put our best spiritual qualities into it. We consecrate, so to say, our whole existence to that first prayer. So the second prayer is just giving substance to the first prayer. And by seeing that, you can see the order. You can see suddenly that the first prayer is not a link, and the second prayer another link, but those two links are linked together. They hang together. So that one feels very very nicely here that, and this is another point I want to bring out now, here you have a wonderful, or even two wonderful examples of how a truth is no more a scientific truth if it is taken out of context. You remember this was, I said on the first hour, this will be one of the points that I will hammer in all through the week, namely that we don't consider every statement of truth or every true statement per se, isolated, that is always a truth. That it is only a truth when it is in its right context. Taken out of it, it is meaningless. It's still a truth, but no more a meaningful truth. Did you mind that I repeated that again? Do you mind if tomorrow and the day afterwards I repeat it again? No? Thank you. Because I was really afraid that in explaining text interpretation, one can't help but repeat and repeat the same thing more often and often with examples, or else it is a theory and one doesn't quite know what to do with it. Now, let's take this. It's only one sentence, really, the whole paragraph. And in this whole sentence, there are two big statements, and both can be taken as an example that they are only true, only meaningful in their context. The first example in this statement is that Mrs. Zeri starts out by saying the divine being must be reflected by man if he wants to be the image and likeness of God. Now, let's take the hypothesis that Mrs. Eddy would have put this at the beginning of the chapter, as starting out with that sentence. And you would agree, I think, with me, or we would agree together, that it would be a very lovely beginning. That it would be a very nice beginning. That she started out and says in the textbook, you know, there is a divine being, and that divine being must be reflected by man, or else man is not the reflection of that divine being, so man would not be really the image and likeness of God. Wouldn't that be nice, a nice start? I would think it would be a nice religious start. Perhaps you start out that way when you discuss Christian Science with your friend or with a beginner. Now, if that sentence had been at the beginning, what truth content would that statement have? What information content would that statement have? Would anybody, when he reads the divine being must be reflected, would anybody know what that divine being is? Is it a two-legged man with a beard sitting on cloud nine and playing the harp? Or what is it? Can you see? Think of that, what Karl Popper said. I mean, Karl Popper is the prominent philosopher of today, though I don't have always great value for philosopher. At least he is trying to show that we have to investigate what we think and see if what we think and say has any substance. Think of that he says any dumb people can state an absolutely irrefutable truth. He can say it will rain, and that cannot be disproved. Just think of that, simple, you know. Sometimes I feel if I give a crude or example, it sticks better than a jolly nice one or a soft one. Think of that always, that it is a truth that cannot be disproved, and it doesn't mean a thing. If something is stated in its infinitude, it loses any content. Only when we take the infinitude and put some information into that infinitude, it becomes tangible and it becomes understandable. Now, if Mrs. Eddy had started with that divine being must be reflected by man, everybody could have thought out something about the divine being, what that divine being is. And if we would go out in the street and ask 100 people, what is the divine being, what do you think the divine being is, we would get 100 different answers. Therefore, it would have no truth content. But if it comes as a second subject, after the first subject, and as the first subject had as its main purpose to show you should desire to know that divine being, and I tell you what that divine being is, the first subject, you remember yesterday, said that divine being is the infinite mind that knows all. That divine being is of the nature of the substance of spirit. That divine being is of the nature of soul, absolutely changeless. That divine being as principle is a science of being. That divine being as life is the source of all existence, bringing forth more than we accept. That divine being is truth that already now does right. You don't have to tell him to do right. And that divine being is of the nature of love. His work is done. So can you see that when then after that, after having given an introduction into the nature of the divine being, then when she says that divine being must be reflected by men, that it means something. That the same term has now a truth content, because it has been explained what the truth content of two terms are, like divine being. Yes? So, can you see that this statement has only is only a scientific truth, so has only information value when it stands where it is, and the same statement would have no truth value if it would stand right at the beginning of the chapter on prayer. Well, where have we been? We have just said that we begin to realize the beauty of the textbook if one sees it in its order. So the moment we read the divine being must be reflected, naturally we think, what is the divine being? And if we don't relate it back to the order, to the context, see, most students naturally would not relate it to the context. They would take the term divine being and say, now what is the divine being? What do I think the divine being is? Instead of asking that this has been already stated in the subject before, and so thought would always relate to the context, here to the context of the first prayer. So this is another point in text interpretation, you see, that if a statement is only true in its context, then naturally one must constantly be aware of that there is a context there. Not to read it just isolated, but always say, with every subject, we will do that as we go on, with every subject we say, why is this possible? It is possible because before we had this and this and this. You see, we must start always relating what we study on a paragraph or on a page or in a subject to the subject before, and even in a way then leads us to thought, well, what must come afterwards? Little by little you even begin to sense when you study a subject like, for instance, here, spirit, and if you have finished spirit, somehow we will sense what the next subject must be. Not can be or might be, but must be. Because more and more through the chain that we build, we know what the next link must be. All right, you look at me a bit. Yeah, that's all right. We'll see it as we go on. So, I said also in this very first paragraph, we have two very distinct examples for this question of context, namely when we come to the second part, but to understand God is the work of eternity and demands what? It demands absolute consecration. Now, we can see that if she would have stopped there, absolute consecration, full stop, we usually say, well, it needs consecration. You know, you have to show for some consecration. You can't study Christian Science without consecration. Don't we say that? Don't we feel that? But what means consecration? What means it? And so, again, you can relate it back. It says, it must be a consecration on that, what you already know. And that's the first prayer. Not to consecrate on something else. So that, she says, it's absolute consecration of what? Of thought, energy, and desire. That was the tonality of the first prayer. So if we say, or if Mrs. Eddy says, well, prayer naturally demands deep consecration. You have to ask consecration on what? Because I want to understand God, therefore I must consecrate on that which I already know, and not on something which is not necessary. Because the Catholic then may say, yes, I do that. I get up in the morning at 5 o'clock and go to the Mass. Yes, I always go and do all the nice jobs in the church and so on. Whatever you say, what the terms are, what the Catholics do, I don't know what the terms. That's their consecration. Is that consecration the same consecration as our consecration? If it is not the same, we have to define it. And so in order to define it, Mrs. Eddy makes that wonderful thing that she always goes back. Very seldom she goes into the future and takes a subject which comes afterwards. She builds. She builds on a basis. So we constantly see as we go on how she builds on the preceding prayers. Yes.